This is Adlai Stevenson in New York.
This is Hugh Gaitskill in London.
This is Pierre Mendès France in Paris.
CBS Radio presents Radio Beat. Tonight, for the first time, CBS Radio brings together by transatlantic circuit three top leaders of the West from Paris, London, and New York to discuss our common position in a divided world. Speaking from New York will be Adlai Stevenson, former presidential candidate of the Democratic Party. From London, Hugh Gaitskill, leader of the British Labour Party. And from Paris, Pierre Mendès France, former premier of France and leader of the Radical Socialist Party. And here, to begin, is our moderator, Dwight Cook.
I suppose that at no time soul-searching debate and examination over its position vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. The official leaders of the big three of the West, England, France, and the United States, have put forth their views. But in decision-making in the free world, there is another force of great dynamics and value and vision, that of the institution known as the Loyal Opposition. The eminent leaders who are not in power, who are frequently opposed to many of the policies of the parties in power, yet who are equally loyal to the institutions and objectives of their countries. Of such a nature are the three eminent guests whom CBS Radio welcomes today to join in this discussion of the position of the West vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Here in the New York studio of CBS Radio with me is Mr. Adlai Stevenson of the United States, connected to us by microphones, headsets, and all the paraphernalia of broadcasting, is Mr. Hugh Gaitskill, the leader of the British Labour Party in London, and a former Prime Minister of France, Mr. Pierre Mendès France, in Paris. Perhaps to begin this, it might be best if I invited you, Mr. Mendès France, to make whatever point you think is most urgent to start off such a discussion. Mr. Mendès France.
For years, we believed we were superior to the Russians in every field. All of a sudden, some people among us who never doubted our superiority have turned into pessimists. I submit their pessimism is just as exaggerated as was their optimism. For one thing is sure, the West has the advantage of greater physical means and resources. And the only question is whether the democracies will know how to make full use of it, as does the East. Why could we not intensify, redirect, and reorganize our efforts so as to face the challenge wherever the Soviets are scoring successes? Of course, we cannot allow our defense progress to be outpaced. Nevertheless, in other fields, initiative and imagination are urgently needed. Economic policies, both domestic and international, have to be renovated. Enlarge investments to accelerate industrialization in the old world and in the underdeveloped countries, expansion of fundamental and technological research, training of many more scientists and technicians, such should be our immediate aims. Above all, an active and bold approach is to be adopted to the problem of underdeveloped countries. Western democracy should help their economic development and political promotion with efficiency and disinterestedness in a most liberal spirit, and this means namely a radical revision of old colonial policies wherever they are still carried. If and when the Western democracies enter into this multifold action, the Soviets will soon realize that their challenge is being met. And they may then change their views and attitude as regards the competition between East and West in many fields, for instance, about the disarmament problems and discussions. For, as I said, their physical means and resources are less than ours, and they know it. Once they feel the West competing successfully in the very fields they expected to dominate, that means science, technology, industrialization, economic assistance to and political promotion of the underdeveloped countries, they may be inclined to think the time has come to stop wasting so much of their hard-needed resources in an armament race which has already led to an equilibrium of terror and is most likely to end anyhow in a costly stalemate. A limited agreement about disarmament on at least a precise point would ease the tension and stimulate means towards peaceful coexistence. It would open the way to the more distant aim of cooperation, which progress and security.
Thank you, Mr. Mendes-France. Mr. Gateskill, you heard Mr. Mendes-France's comments. I notice that he focuses upon a prerequisite to any kind of a disarmament or limited peace agreement, a stronger economic setup and virility by the West. Does this fit in with your pattern, Mr. Gateskill?
Well, I wouldn't myself take the view that we should wait for the summit conference until we feel ourselves economically stronger. For one thing, it's extremely difficult to say when a country or a group of countries is economically stronger than another. And as we happen to be, well, so far as the United States is concerned, in at least a minor economic recession, which may go on for a little time, I must make it plain that I would be strongly against any deferment of summit talks until the recession in the United States is over. But I don't think really, if I may say so, that was what Monsieur Mendes-France was saying. And I would like to pick up one or two other things, if I may, which he mentioned. I agree very generally with what he said. I accept his sort of approach to the problem that faces us. If the Russians are forging ahead fast, it is, I think, largely because, as a dictatorship, they can impose upon their people a very high rate of saving and a corresponding high rate of investment, together with a very big expenditure on defense. And it undoubtedly is difficult for the democracies to match that, though fortunately they start, particularly the United States, with a very long lead. And if one looks at Russia, there is a more encouraging feature which I think must be brought in, and that is that as technical progress takes place and all this technical education goes on in Russia, I believe myself there will be a stronger and stronger demand from the new managerial and technical classes for a greater degree of freedom internally. Indeed, there have already been signs of that in the last few years. Then, as to underdeveloped countries, I agree entirely that we ought to do everything we can to help them. But I would like to make a few suggestions here. I think it is quite wrong to make conditions about the economic aid that you are giving to these countries. You're giving it partly because it seems to most of us to be right and proper that richer countries should help poorer countries to raise their standard of living, and partly because we want to help the democracies in the underdeveloped areas to get through their economic revolution while preserving their democratic institutions. And they won't, I think, be able to do that unless they get a certain amount of help from outside. But it would be fatal if this help were in any way associated with what are called old colonial policies. I wholly agree with Monsieur Mendes-France on that point. I myself would go a little further, and I'd like to know what Mr. Stevenson feels about this. We believe in our party not only that there should be help for the underdeveloped countries, but that there's a great deal to be said for channeling this help through the United Nations, through some scheme like the SunFed scheme. And we believe that because that would take the politics out of it.
This seems a nice point, Mr. Gateskill, to bring in Mr. Stevenson. So far, we've heard from Mr. Mendes-France in Paris and you, Mr. Hugh Gateskill, in London. Now, Mr. Adlai Stevenson here in New York.
I think that the areas that have already been covered have certainly highlighted those aspects of the current scene which must attract our first attention. Mr. Mendes-France said something that interested me a great deal. He said, as I understood him, the pessimism of today is as exaggerated as the optimism of yesterday about the invincibility of the West in education in every respect. I think I emphatically agree with what Mr. Mendes-France said, and it reminds me also of the spirit that pervaded this country and I think in a lesser degree much of Western Europe after Geneva, and that might be something that would be well to recall in contemplation of a summit meeting now. I think specifically we should remember that last summit conference at Geneva in 1955, and that while Western leaders basked in what they regarded as their great successes, Moscow was negotiating the Egyptian arms deal and accelerating its development and testing of missiles and so forth. I think we should be aware now, at least this is my impression, that the Soviet Union is undoubtedly trying to exploit what it regards as a perhaps transient stage of Western disarray, that it's trying to create an atmosphere in which the West relaxes the efforts that have been stimulated by Sputnik, by the pessimism, by the awakening to which Mr. Mendes-France referred. The Soviet Union continues its pace, both in the development of weapons systems and likewise carries forward the very promising, very effective political, economic, and psychological penetration of these areas to which Mr. Gaitskill has just referred. Now, as to the summit, I think that there must be some difference between us, between the United States, that is to say, and our oldest and dearest and greatest allies abroad. And I think one of the most unhappy things that could happen, and here I remind you that I am what we call in the opposition in this country, it would be a very unhappy thing if we let the Soviet Union force us into a meeting where the United States is further split off from its allies, that this is the last thing we should permit to happen. As to this forthcoming meeting, it would be a pity if our expectations were too high. There is, however, reason for hope and optimism that we might accomplish something on a less exalted scale. The proposals that have been made from time to time, as long as 2 years ago in this country by myself, by Mr. Gaitskill and others abroad, with respect to the discontinuance of the testing of hydrogen weapons. We believe, with suitable inspection here, that that's a necessary precaution. And if this could be accomplished at the summit this time, this would establish the principle, the mechanics, perhaps, of an inspection system, at least look in that direction. But to take up the things that Mr. Gaitskill referred to, or the problem of the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Eastern Europe, and I mean the disengagement, these things will take time. They must proceed in carefully planned stages, I should think, and that these cannot be decided upon in a few days, amid the bright lights, the confusion, the diversion of a summit meeting. What the West should seek to agree upon before the meeting and dramatize at the meeting, I should think, is what a sensible progression might look like at some future time. And it would seek agreement with Moscow now as to where we can begin.
Let's go back across the Atlantic and see what Mr. Gaitskill and Mr. Mendes-France think about a summit meeting and the conditions thereof. Mr. Gaitskill?
Well, I was glad to notice that Mr. Stevenson did refer to this forthcoming meeting, from which I presume that he thinks it is going to take place and that it is desirable that it should take place.
I tried to make the point that I thought it would be a pity to be forced into a meeting where the United States is furthest divided from its allies, that assuming that this can be avoided and that we can reach a suitable agenda and can have some preliminary talks and have some kind of an understanding of what we're going to talk about, I think we should have a meeting, yes.
Yeah, well, obviously, we've got to have both talks among ourselves beforehand, so as to decide what our line should be, and also there have got to be some talks with the other side, with the Russians and whoever they bring along, as to the nature of the conference. But I think there are two rather different views of this summit conference which one wants to distinguish. On the whole, the Western view, and particularly the United States view, has been that this should be what I have called an apex conference, something you reach eventually after there's been a great deal of discussion and thrashing out of problems between foreign secretaries or perhaps between ambassadors. And then at the end of it all, the heads of the states come along and, so to speak, sign on the dotted line or deal with the remaining problems. And I fully agree that that is one possible way of proceeding. But my impression is that the Russians, of course, they may change their minds on this, not thinking really of a summit conference in those terms, they're thinking of it more in terms of what I've called the ice-breaking type of conference. And personally, I think it would be a great pity to turn that down if, in fact, it becomes clear that this is what the Russians want. And that, I think, is one of the points at issue between the United States and, at any rate, a good many people in Britain at the moment. It is the apparent insistence that we must, first of all, negotiate at a lower level. And I've no objection to this if the Russians agree. I think it would be a great mistake to insist upon that, because I think they have this idea that, well, let's get together and make a start.
If I could interrupt you, Mr. Gaitskill, you raise a rather important point there. I think Mr. Mendes-France in Paris would probably like to get in on that point.
Yeah.
Mr. Mendes-France?
What I want to say is that if the internal policies in the West, especially in countries like France, will be changed, will be reconverted for our economic problems, our cultural progresses, and of course the problems with the overseas territories. At this time, I'm quite sure that tremendous changes in the international climate will take place, and that the kind of relations which we have with the East might be very different, because the East will understand that the type of competition which was so successful for them on some points in the past will change, and that their challenge will be met successfully by the West. The chance for the Soviets today, their chance is our weaknesses, our mistakes, our hesitations. Once they feel that we have made the point and we are decided to go ahead with these problems, I think the type of discussion with them will change. Anyway, coming back to the summit conference, my idea is the same as Mr. Gaitskill. I think it might be very dangerous to give to the international public opinion, especially in the other countries, the feeling that we fear the confrontation or the discussion which the USSR are proposing. So, taking into account, of course, the necessity of preparing by some talks or by some procedure which has to be set, especially between the Western countries themselves, I should insist that we avoid to give the false impression that we are not in favor of international talks at the higher level.
To use Mr. Gaitskill's phrase of an ice-breaking summit conference, Mr. Mendes.
Well, that's good.
Mr. Stevenson?
I think Mr. Gaitskill said, as many people abroad saw the situation, the impression was that the United States took a rather firm position that we must negotiate at a lower level, preliminary to meeting at a higher level. Whereas the attitude of the USSR was that let's get together and make a start. I think there has been probably, and I'm sure it's no secret, I have felt that the position of my government has been too rigid for years in many respects. That may be improving now, I'm happy to say.
Good.
I don't believe I can, however, embrace the latter proposition, that the attitude of the Russians is let's get together and make a start. I wonder if the attitude isn't perhaps let's get together and make propaganda.
Well,
and we must be awfully careful about that, because the saddest thing that could befall not only one another, but the world and security and peace, is a further division between these Western powers and their common interest in a more secure world and a just peace, I think. I think it's better to know what we are going to talk about in advance and not permit ourselves to be further divided or on the spot, if that were the consequence. Mr. Mendes-France says our weakness is their chance and that their attitude will change if we are of more certain heart. I must say I agree with that. I think that's good sound advice. I can't but feel that if we could take some steps towards ending the nuclear arms race, which is the only hope for security and peace in the world, really, in the long run, at such a conference we would have made an enormous progress, and that ultimately it would have another incidental and most important effect. It would gradually tend to make Russia an open society. Would gradually tend to release resources to improve the Soviet standard of living, converting the level of welfare into the central question of Soviet politics as it is the central question in the politics of Great Britain, the United States, and France.
Intimately connected, gentlemen, with these questions of nuclear disarmament at a summit conference is this question of disengagement, if any, in Central Europe. I think all of you have been concerned with that. Mr. Gaitskill?
Yeah. Well, may I, Mr. Cooks, just make one or two other points about summit and tests and things before we come on to that? Do you mind if I do?
Certainly not.
First of all, I, of course, agree with Mr. Stevenson that the Soviet may be simply anxious to make propaganda. We don't know that. I think if they have an opportunity, they may well do that. And no doubt it would suit their book very well to divide the Western allies. But, you know, I think here I very much agree with the Simondis France that if we refuse the summit talks, if we adopt, as it were, a standoffish and terribly cautious and reserved manner, we play right into the Russian hands. That is the sort of propaganda that does divide the Allies. And I think myself that if it is a matter, if it is propaganda, good heavens, let us have a little confidence in ourselves. Let us surely say to ourselves, we can play that game too if they want to play it. we want peace, we should be able to work out definite proposals for this, but it seems to me we're always giving the Russians the tricks in this business. We're never really playing the game. If they want propaganda, right, we can do that too. But if they don't want propaganda, if they want to talk seriously, well, of course, so much the better, then we'll talk seriously too. I entirely agree that one doesn't want to give the impression that this is the conference to secure permanent peace once and for all. I don't believe public opinion thinks in those terms now. They know very well that they're frightfully difficult problems and they would welcome simply a start on it. Now, as to tests, I, of course, here entirely agree with Mr. Stevenson. We in the Labour Party in Britain have urged two things for a long time. First of all, that the Russian proposals to suspend nuclear tests under proper controls, but independent of disarmament agreement in other directions, should have been accepted. I believe the West made, at 10 or 8, a tactical error in refusing that, but insisting on tying the suspension of tests to other parts of a disarmament agreement. Of course, that isn't to say that the suspension of tests is all we want. It's got to be followed, if it's really to be worthwhile, by an agreement on the control over nuclear production. But I entirely agree with Mr. Stevenson. This is the point at which there is less difference between the Soviet and the West, and I think we could bridge that gap without any serious military risk to ourselves by saying, right, we'll buy the suspension of tests for the 2 years, which I think Mr. Bulganin proposed in his recent note. And then we would say, well, now we'll take that, but now we'll go on. And we'll warn you, I don't mind us saying this, we warn you that unless within these 2 years we can reach some further agreement on disarmament, well, don't expect the suspension to go on. Now, that's roughly my point of view, and I think it is pretty much the same as Mr. Stevenson's.
Mr. Stevenson spoke about the 1955 lesson, and he spoke about this conference, which was only a conference for a mood of good humor. And that's true. I don't say it was useless, because after all, good humor is better than bad humor. But yeah, I must confess that no results came out. I feel perhaps there were no results because we were not able at this point to bring precise and concrete proposals which might have some impact in the public opinion. Mr. Gaitskell spoke about propaganda occasions in such conferences. That's true. But why must propaganda always work on one side? After all, we might find in such opportunities the way of making our own propaganda for our own thesis. I would give you only one example. I said that in 1955 we were not able to make some concrete proposals. There was one exception brought up at this time by the West, and this was the open sky inspections. Well, this is a very popular idea. It was not useless to have brought that at this time, and speaking about propaganda, it was a good thing. So I feel that in such occasions, we must not have these complexes and we must try to take such occasions and go there with precise and deeply studied proposals. I think that one point must be brought by the West when such conferences will meet, and that is the underdeveloped countries' problems, because this, in my idea, is the most important problem for the time being. So if we approach the next conference with a set of good proposals studied by the Western countries, some of them might have some success and it will be good for the world peace. And on the propaganda side, if nothing else comes out, well, we'll have won here too.
What Mr. Mendes-France says seems to me to suggest that we should approach this meeting with precise, I believe he said, and carefully considered proposals. This, I think, is correct. I notice in Mr. Gaitskell's suggestion about the suspension of nuclear testing that it's probably an agreement to do it unilaterally without inspection. It seems to me that while suspending the tests...
May I interrupt you there?
Yes,
Stevenson.
Sir.
I perhaps didn't make myself clear. Now, the Russians, after all, have proposed the suspension of nuclear tests on more than one occasion, but most recently, I think, in one of Mr. Bulganin's letters about the summit talks...
Yes, the one in December, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Now, what I said was, first of all, that we should accept that. We shouldn't have tied it to general disarmament agreement, but that would be a multilateral agreement to suspend tests. But it is fair to add that we in the Labour Party have also said that our government, in order to give a lead in this, should have made and should still make a proposition to suspend their own tests for a limited period in the hope of creating a better atmosphere and the hope that other people would then join in.
I see.
There are two proposals, but I took the multilateral one as being the one that's likely to be most interest to both of you.
Yes, well, I think I understand now. I think you'd agree that if we could establish the principle of inspection on one another's territory, it would be a step in the direction of broader inspection, the aerial inspection, the open skies, the ground inspection to prevent surprise attack. This would be an enormous step forward. This would tend to break down the isolation, the secrecy, the mistrust that has existed before us and that underlies much of our difficulty. We don't get anywhere because we don't trust anyone. I feel that the package program that our governments have agreed upon to present as a disarmament proposal, and that inference being that it must be accepted in whole or not at all, should be broken down, and that we should start with inspection, and if it can first relate to suspension of nuclear weapons, and we three could agree upon that, I should have thought we'd have made very considerable progress here as well as at the summit.
Good.
Now, may I add another word about what has pleased me a great deal, and that seems to be that there's emerged here in what Mr. Mendes-France has said, and I gather from what Mr. Gaitskill has said, that they both attached prior importance to development in the underdeveloped territories. This seems to me very interesting because much of the press is preoccupied with weapons, with missiles, with the posture of defense, with the condition of our forces in NATO, with the summit meeting, and I personally feel that more important even than that is the revolutions in the underdeveloped territories and the direction in which they're going to go in the future. This seems to be also the view of my confrère abroad, and if it is, I think it will tend in the direction of inviting greater public attention to a problem that seems to me very much neglected.
We'll be back with Radio Beat after a 30-second pause for station identification. This is the CBS Radio Network. We return you to Radio Beat, bringing you today a discussion between Adlai Stevenson, Hugh Gaitskill, and Pierre Mendes-France. Now, here is Dwight Cook.
Necessarily, gentlemen, at this point, a great deal of public attention is directed to one aspect of the underdeveloped countries known as North Africa.
I think that passes the ball to Monsieur Mendes-France, doesn't it?
Well, unless you'd like to pick it up, Hugh, I'm sure I don't want it.
No, I think we let him take the hot potato, I think is the word, isn't it? The phrase we use for this.
I don't know what it would be in French, Mr. Mendes-France, but only pick it up if you wish to.
Well, for the time being, we have a procedure of bons office, and you both are in the countries which are conducting these bons office. So we have to wait for your ideas and suggestions. As you know, I always was in favor of realizing a reconversion of the relationship between the colonial countries and the overseas territories. It's a very difficult and acute point in France for the time being. But I think that there is some progresses in public opinion here, and I hope that we might have some evolution, perhaps, in the near future, and we might have some changes. I hope so, anyway. Of course, it's awfully difficult, because we have to explain to our people the changes which the 20th century has brought.
Well, Mr. Mendes-France, Mr. Gaitskill would share my view of great encouragement by the words you've just uttered. I think your idea was that the suggestion of evolution in the future and changes and progress in public opinion, which must point in the direction of a solution of the problem in North Africa, which I must say has ceased to be just a vital concern of France, but has become a vital concern of the United States and all of France's allies.
Yes, I fully agree with that. I don't think anybody would pretend that this is a straightforward or simple problem, and not even a straight question of clearing out of some colony. When you have a large French population in Algeria as well, you have all the racial questions and difficulties of that sort. But I'm bound to say I think there is a good deal of anxiety in Great Britain, at any rate, about the Algerian situation, and the feeling that the solution by force, which so far seems to have been pursued, is never really going to be a solution in the long run, and that negotiations sooner or later have got to take place with the leaders of the Algerian people. I don't think it would be right to go further than that. I know the difficulties of the people leading the present movement and the unwillingness of the French government to negotiate with them.
I feel, as you do, that there is no solution in such problems by force in the long run. That's definitely sure. The difficulty is to find an appropriate procedure to have discussion between the party concerned. Of course, there is a great deal of sensibility in my country about these problems, but I think that everybody now in this country understands that at some stage, some kind of negotiation will be necessary. Of course, it's difficult to know exactly who will be the other partner, because after all, the Algerian population, for the time being, has no official representation, nor has it any convenient way to choose authentic representation. But we have to find that, and perhaps it's not a bad thing at a given stage to ask the Tunisian and Moroccan countries to help to find a way to come out.
I wonder, Mr. Cook, if we could go back to disengagement, which in fact we never got on to.
It might be interesting, Mr. Gaitskill, and perhaps then the buns off feats of the good offices of Britain and France could contribute to an American greater wisdom on the subject.
All right, would you like me to start?
If you would.
Well, let me preface what I'm going to say by saying just this. I find a lot of people who take the view that if you are putting forward proposals for relaxing tension, whether through disarmament or through what we call disengagement, some new idea for trying to get a settlement with the Russians, there are a lot of people who think that that means you're soft on defense, that you're no longer keen about NATO, that you don't care about the unity of the West. I want to say emphatically that I think that is absolute nonsense. And I want to declare my own point of view, which is that I've been always a strong supporter of NATO, of the Atlantic Alliance, and that I fully agree with what Mr. Stevenson said earlier on, that we have got to keep up our guard. But I'm equally clear that to stand in a position of sort of frozen immobility, what I described, to mix the metaphors a bit, as a Maginot Line mentality, without any attempt to reach settlements with the Russians, or indeed cope with the propaganda war, if that's what it is, which they're conducting, I believe that to do that is in fact fatal to the West, because it undermines the confidence and feeling of unity in the West, since so many people are desperately anxious and goodness knows natural enough to try and get some settlement. Now then, what sort of settlement? Well, if we take Europe, I think it would be generally agreed that there are two major problems. One is the position of Germany today, and the second is the position of the satellite states. And it is no exaggeration to say that as far as Germany goes, if there were to be, say, next year, a rising in East Germany, like the one in 1953, a very dangerous situation indeed would develop, because you will now have a West German army. In a year's time, it will be considerably stronger, and there will be an enormous temptation, to put it no higher, for the West Germans to go to the help of their East German comrades, the other side of the Iron Curtain. If that were to happen, obviously the danger of World War III is immediately apparent. That's one reason why I think we've got to forestall it. And equally, I don't mind saying I don't want to get into the position again that we all found ourselves in the autumn of 1956, when the Hungarian Rising took place. And we had to stand by, ashamed and angry and helpless, because if we had moved in any military sense to help the Hungarian rebels, that might have precipitated World War III too. And if we can't do anything to help them directly, and I take that for granted, in a military sense, well then, for heaven's sake, let's see if we can do anything diplomatically. That's the background to the disengagement proposals, which I would like to put forward. But perhaps, because I don't want to speak too long at one burst, if my two colleagues would agree with that sort of general approach, we could get on to the detail.
Do they agree?
Well, they agree. It's a good approach.
Good.
Well, certainly,
good.
I think everyone agrees that if we could withdraw and restore peace to the world, we'd achieve the objective that we all seek.
Well,
the question is how.
Yeah, but that's putting it more precisely than that, Mr. Stevenson. I'm saying that I don't think, now put it the other way around, I know a number of people in Europe and America who really prefer the status quo because they're frightened of any change.
Well, I think that's a pity. I agree with you. That's foolish.
Good. Well, that's what I want to get out of the way. Now then, we've put forward a plan for the past 18 months, and I'd like to begin with that, if I may. And it's a quite straightforward five-point plan involving the following changes. First of all, the withdrawal of foreign forces from East and West Germany, from Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary. Secondly, a international control over the conventional national forces, or indeed, if you like, nuclear as well, but an international control over the national forces allowed to that area, and of course agreed with the countries in that area. So that in itself, the second point, is really a pilot scheme of local control disarmament. Thirdly, the reunification of Germany, and fourthly, the signing of a security pact under which the frontiers of these countries and this area would be guaranteed mutually by the countries themselves and by the great powers. And finally, provided all the rest is agreed, then I would say, right, West Germany and East Germany say we withdraw from NATO, Poland, Hungary and Czechoslovakia withdraw from the Warsaw Pact. That is the full plan for what we call a neutral zone or neutral belt. Now, I believe if that could be agreed, it would be an enormous advance. It would, as I say, first of all, bring you your experiment in controlled disarmament. It would, secondly, solve the German problem and reduce the danger from that. And it would, thirdly, at least advance the prospect of a greater degree of freedom and independence for the three satellite states. Three very, very important objectives. I haven't time to discuss all the arguments against it, but I'll just say this. They are usually contradictory. The same people will say to you, this would be terribly dangerous for the West. And at the same time, they will say, Russia, of course, will never do it. Well, I don't think both those criticisms can be true. I don't myself think it is dangerous for the West, but I do admit it may well be that to start with, the Russians would be very unwilling to go as far as this, which brings me, if I may just bring it in and then I'll shut up, the more limited proposal, which starts from the Rapatsky plan, a plan for a nuclear-free zone in the two Germanies and in Poland and Czechoslovakia. Now, I have said many times and say it again, that's not enough for me. But I think if you could move on from the Rapatsky plan as it stands to bring in conventional forces as well and attenuate the reduction of foreign forces, you are achieving one objective. You are achieving your limited controlled disarmament. Because I'm frankly doubtful, in the light of our experience of the disarmament committee, whether we're going to get the Russians or the United States, for that matter, to jump straight away into a full international control of all their armies at home.
You brought up quite a point there, Mr. Gateskill. I think Mr. Stevenson and Mr. Mendes-France are very eager to comment on it.
Well, I would like to say, Mr. Cook, that I don't exclude the possibility of making progress with respect to disengagement. In fact, I would go so far as to say that I think disengagement will be the ultimate solution of the relations between East and West, that you can't have foreign armies glowering at each other over international boundaries with any security indefinitely. I wish, however, I shared his confidence that we're in a position now where we could proceed with much security in this direction. I'm obliged to recall that it wasn't long ago that in Hungary, where the first manifestations of democratic evolution or developments immediately resulted in the re-entry of Russian troops. Well, now, if we withdraw all of our forces as we're presently situated from Central and Eastern Europe, the Russians withdraw to their boundaries, the United States withdraws clear across the Atlantic, and
I must clear that up. I've never said that, Mr. Stevenson, and I must disassociate myself from some interpretations of Mr. Kennan on that point. Though even he didn't say that, he said only to Britain. No, I'm sorry, if I may just interrupt, I've always said NATO goes on, and British and American forces remain in Europe, but not in Western Germany.
Well, not at all. That's a very proper correction. Perhaps I could go back to that in a moment. Let me make this point. I'm concerned, Mr. Gateskill, about it now because we've just had the illustration of Hungary, when, with democratic developments taking place there, the Red Army re-entered the country. Now, if we withdraw, and isn't it to be assumed that the same thing takes place, they re-enter again? Would we re-enter? And if we do, haven't we asked for the very thing that we're trying to avoid, a collision? Or what if we don't? Then they're back in and we're out. Now, the other point that you made about the withdrawal, I was confidently informed in Europe last summer that there was nowhere else for the American forces to go but Germany. Now, if there are other places for them to go, that certainly improves the situation a great deal.
Perhaps Mr. Mendes-France would like to add his point in here before you come back, Mr. Casegood.
Yeah, right here.
That's a very large thing, and I must make some reservations about some ideas which he said he favored. I must say that subject to certain amendments or changes, I think that the Rapatsky approach might be studied with realism, and there might be some solution in such direction. Not with the behind thoughts, as Mr. Gaitskell, to come later on to this large neutralization plan, but to come to some organization about disarmament control and limitation. It might be a good experiment to have on some place in the world, which after all is the most dangerous point, it's Central Europe, where the two blocks are elbow by elbow. And this is the reason why I think we must not refuse these proposals, and we have to see how it could work and what kind of amendments we could propose. At the same time, I wish to add one thing, that my idea doesn't mean that we must go to departure of U.S. troops in Germany or in continental Europe. I think that the presence of the American troops is, by any way, a guarantee for peace, and that any scheme which we will prepare and study must include the presence of U.S. troops on continental Europe and in Western Germany.
Mr. Gaitskell?
First of all, I won't argue my major case again. As far as Mr. Mendes-France is concerned, I think he and I are in agreement about the Rapatsky proposals and the kind of thing that might come out of them. The only thing I would insist myself is that it's no use just having a nuclear-free zone. You must have a zone under which there is control over conventional forces as well, and they should be reduced. And equally, I would certainly like to see some reduction in foreign forces. As regards Mr. Stevenson's two points, that nowhere else for the Americans to go, I find that rather astonishing. I think there are only four divisions of American troops in Europe, which is not an enormous number. There's the whole of the Low Countries and France and Britain, and I wouldn't have thought it was impossible to contain them there, if indeed as many American troops would be necessary in this new, and I hope more relaxed, situation. But I do repeat, I certainly want to see American forces in some form or other retained for the time being on the continent of Europe. The other point was his argument that if you did have my full plan, then as soon as the Soviet troops withdrawn, the communist regimes would be overthrown and back the Soviet troops would come. Well, of course, the logic of that, Mr. Stevenson, is rather horrifying, you know, because it implies that you must not do anything which could possibly disturb the communist regimes in Eastern Europe. And that I find it very difficult to stomach. But my answer, I think, would it be twofold. First of all, if there is a security pact, a guarantee of the frontiers, then the re-entry of Russian forces would be a breach of that agreement. That is what I've got in mind. And therefore it would give the West the right to re-enter, and of course you would be back where you were, or something like it.
Or else you'd be in a major war.
Well, you might be in a major war. You might be in a major war, but I do not think that in the least any more likely than you would be now. But the second point I would make is this. If you make a pact of this kind, and the Russians make it, it seems to me in the highest degree unlikely that they will not have taken for granted that they are going to lose complete control over these areas. In any event, I'm not suggesting that this is the sort of thing the Russians will agree to tomorrow. I think this will take years of negotiation, and I think the more limited proposals which we've been talking about may well be a stage in that direction. But I do, I repeat, find it extremely hard to accept from anybody, and I'm in a way, if I may say so, surprised that it comes from you, this notion that the one thing we must not do is in any way to shake these regimes, because then the Russians will do something or other which will precipitate a Third World War. That really is, I say so with respect, too defeatist a view.
Well, I hardly know what to say. If Mr. Gaitskill recalls, I said at the outset that I did not exclude the possibility. Indeed, I suspected that disengagement was the only ultimate solution of our problem in Western Europe. I should have thought that at this moment, practically in the shadow of what happened in Hungary, what happened in East Germany, what happened in Poznan, that the idea now that we could view with any confidence the democratic evolution of these countries with the withdrawal of control by the Soviet Union seems to be quite unlikely.
Well,
I hope very much that I'm wrong about that.
Yeah. That's a different argument, if I may say so. I think it is quite unlikely that the Russians at the moment will agree, as I said earlier on, either to the full evacuation of foreign forces or to the reunification of Germany, things go together. But what I don't like, I hope I haven't been too rude, but we had this argument presented by the present government in the House of Commons the other day, and it upset us a good deal.
I get upset by my government's arguments every day.
You'll understand my point of view then.
I do indeed. If I may add a further word, sir, I'd like to go back to economic development. I think our interest, and I'm sure here we must have very common views, lies in assisting these new nations of Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and so on, to advance towards a modern economic political status while maintaining their independence and assuring the possibility of an evolution which, by the methods of consent, as we call it, which protect and safeguard the individual. Certainly, a democratically oriented, independent Asia, Middle East, and so on is what we all have in mind. We shall make much more demonstrable progress both for their sake and our security in that direction by economic methods than we will by military methods. Here, I think we have a great opportunity. I should have thought that we ought to coordinate our efforts in that direction. By this, I mean the capital-rich countries of the West should sit around a table, should determine what the needs are, allocate them according to where the resources of skills and money are among us, and do a much more effective and coordinated job than we have up until now. Now, Mr. Gaitskill earlier suggested it should be all done through the UN. Not as sanguine that we can do it as effectively as we could, however, if we sat around very much the way we organized the Marshall Plan. It might be certainly well worth trying it. I would certainly feel that we should call the Russians in. We should ask Mr. Khrushchev to participate, if you will, along with us in the development of the Aswan Dam or whatever you have. And if he says no, if he says he'll do it alone or not at all, well, at least, as you said, it unmasks the objectives, which are more political then than they are genuinely disinterested development. I would urge, however, a consideration, which I have urged on my government with limited success, of a greater degree of coordination of our effort in the economic field. I should have thought we could do it through the existing agency of OEEC, the Office for Economic Cooperation in Europe. There are other agencies, too, that might be available, certainly for regional work such as the Colombo Plan. This seems to me a matter of first consequence, and that I wish the Western states were giving it much more collective attention.
Before we sum up this discussion, gentlemen, Mr. Mendes, France raised underdeveloped countries and economic problems at the beginning of the broadcast. Mr. Gaitskill is a former professor of economics. Do either of you wish to add something from London or Paris on Mr. Stevenson's specific point? Mr. Mendes, France?
I was interested by what was said now by Mr. Stevenson and by Mr. Gaitskill, especially when he mentioned that underdeveloped countries' help must not be associated with political conditions. And we have no objection, of course, that these helps being coordinated by the United Nations organization. Perhaps some other international schemes might work usefully. I was interested by the Colombo Plan, and I must say that we in France, we have made a lot in the underdeveloped countries which are connected with us. We have made some mistakes, I must confess, in some of our overseas territories, but at the same time, we have done a lot for them, and we have provided them for the 10 last years about 3% of our national income, which I think is more than any other country did. This does not mean that no coordination on the international level must not be built. I'm in favor of such organizations, but I stress that the channels which are now working well, like the Colombo Plan or some others, must be kept in use. I hope that all these kind of ideas can be worked quite soon and will give good results on the underdeveloped countries problem, which is the most important challenge that we are facing today.
This is such a big subject, we really haven't had time to go into it in detail. an enormous amount is known about the technical, economic, and psychological, sociological problems involved. The real problem here is, frankly, the will of the peoples and the governments to give effect to what everybody knows ought to be done.
Perhaps, gentlemen, I might ask you a very difficult question for a very brief answer to sum up all this. Mr. Gaitskill, why don't we start with you, because you've just been talking in London. What final sentence or short paragraph would you like most to stress to close this kind of an exploration?
Well, I would like to see the Western powers showing far more initiative than they have done in putting forward positive proposals for peace. I should like to see them making a much greater attempt to reach even limited agreements with Russia while preserving the balance of security which we know must be preserved. I think if they do this, they will also have a very much better chance of winning whatever propaganda battle is going on, and also at the same time in sustaining the morale of the peoples of Western Europe.
Thank you, Mr. Gaitskill. Mr. Mendes, France and Paris?
Well, I agree with Mr. Gaitskill when he said that Western world must show more initiative, and I think that we have to show more initiative when the next high-level conference will meet, whatever it is. The initiatives I would like the most are the underdeveloped countries' problems and the control of armaments. Perhaps it will be difficult to have limitation of armaments, but if some agreement comes, at least on a precise point, this will be a first step which might be useful for the development of peace later on.
And Mr. Adlai Stevenson in New York.
Well, I'll address my concluding remark, if I can, to the Soviet Union. I'd like to say that I think a wise Russian policy would be to direct its efforts now in the light of Sputnik and nuclear and hydrogen developments, in the creation of a system of armaments controls, and concerting its efforts, along with ours and others, on making that system solid and secure, and also concerting its efforts along with ours in the development of these newly independent countries with a view to independence and security the world around.
Well, gentlemen, certainly you should be congratulated as men of goodwill working in studios in three different capitals of the world, discussing together tremendously complicated questions and questions of considerable personal implication to yourselves. But beyond being men of goodwill, it seems to me you deserve salutation as men of ideas. For in the final analysis, I'm sure you would all agree, it is ideas which are the ultimate weapon of the free world against any totalitarian system. Thank you for today's discussion.
You have been listening to Radio Beat, which brought you tonight for the first time by Transatlantic Circuit, three top leaders of the West, from Paris, London, and New York, in a discussion on our position in a divided world. Participating in this exchange were Adlai Stevenson, former presidential candidate of the Democratic Party, Hugh Gaitskill, leader of the British Labour Party, and Pierre Mendès-France, former French premier and leader of the Radical Socialist Party. Our moderator was Dwight Cook. This has been another broadcast in the public interest from CBS News. Only a network like the CBS Radio Network can present this kind of service. Only a station affiliated with CBS Radio can bring it to you. Radio Beat was produced by George Vikas, supervised by Ralph Backlund, and was a Unit 1 presentation of CBS News.